read verse number 1. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? So chapter 17 ended with a series of three episodes that all highlighted faith. So the disciples lacked faith when they failed to cast the demon out of a boy. The reality of faith was brought home to them when Jesus again predicted his death. And then Jesus gave Peter a lesson in faith that the kingdom is not here in this age, and that means subjection and humility now. Now, of course, the wrong message to take from those passages in chapter 17 would be thinking that faith somehow equals a blank check. Like we've been given a blank check that's signed and we can just make it out for whatever amount, if we have enough faith, whatever amount we want to. Well, faith is not about quantity. It's not about magnitude. It's not about the strength of desire for something. Faith is about believing and trusting Jesus. It is about understanding his working of all things according to his purpose from before the foundation of the world and submitting our own wills to his. So even if you think about the prayers of Jesus that we see later in the gospel accounts in the garden when he prays to the Father and he says, Not my will, but thine be done. So I certainly don't want anyone to go away thinking that I'm saying, oh, well, we don't pray about all of our burdens and all of our cares and the things that are on our minds and hearts. No, we absolutely do, but we always do so in submission to the Father's will. That's what Jesus has taught us. That's what Jesus has modeled us. So we look at chapter 17 and realize that Jesus is telling the apostles that they had been called to a work. They had been authorized to be able to cast out demons and to do all of these things. And so that should not have been impossible for them. But they lacked faith. They didn't really understand many of those things that Jesus was teaching them at the time. And at the end of chapter 17, Jesus chose not to give offense and to submit to the temple tax, even though he was not under obligation to do so. So this age before the kingdom comes is characterized by faith, it's characterized by humility, it's characterized by subjection. And I'm talking about this is on the part of those who believe in Jesus Christ, those who are his followers. Well, that leads us right into chapter 18, which chapter 18 is the next large section of teaching in Matthew. And this entire chapter has the theme of humility that runs through it. It comes into different considerations, but it's humility all the way through. This section is kicked off by what we know is a dispute between the disciples about which of them would be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And there was, on the part of the disciples, there certainly was excitement for the kingdom among the 12 in particular. And each of them were concerned about what their place of authority would be, what position am I going to hold in the kingdom? And not only were they concerned about what position am I going to hold in the kingdom, but they also wanted to know the positions of the others so that I know that I've got a greater position than these others. And these were things that were foremost in their mind. And so when they say greatest, of course, they're talking of the highest only next to Jesus. But the greatest next to Jesus, of course. So this section continues the theme that we see really in the latter part of Matthew's gospel in particular, and that's the preparation of the disciples. Jesus is preparing the disciples. He's preparing them for his death that is coming, for his departure. He's going to go away, and that's going to become more prominent as we go through the gospel as well. And Jesus is preparing them for that. And Jesus is also preparing them for the work that they've been called to as apostles, and what this office is about, what work is before them, and how they need to go about it. So as we look at this passage here at the beginning of chapter number 18, we see that in verses 1 to 9, the question about who is the greatest in the kingdom, and in verses 10 to 14, we see there's the parable of the lost sheep. And so we want to begin looking here in the first part in the greatest in the kingdom. And we'll begin again with verse number 1. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" So you notice that Matthew, in the way that this verse starts, he connects and he also separates with this phrase, "at the same time." So this section is marked off as a new section. In other words, as you're reading through, and again, it's not that it says chapter 18 there, but as you're reading through, you can see that there is a distinction here. And we'll see by the time we get to the end of it as well that it's clearly marked off as a section, just as the ones before it have been. But it's also connected to what has gone before. It's not like Matthew is starting some grand new subject here that hasn't touched on or hasn't come before. So in his account, he gets straight to this question by the disciples: who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And when you read Mark and Luke's account, they both make it clear that this exchange was occasioned by the fact that there was disputing going on among the disciples about which of them would be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now, Matthew doesn't emphasize the dispute between them as much as Mark and Luke do, but we do know that that was what occasioned this question. Essentially, Jesus engaged them over this, and so this question comes out. But from the start in this passage, and especially coming out of what we have in chapter 17, Matthew is showing here that there's a lack of faith on the part of the disciples, a part of the 12, and it's consistent with those previous episodes because this very question means that they haven't really understood what Jesus has taught about the kingdom very well. I'm not saying they know nothing about it. I'm just saying they don't have all of these things put together as they ought. And so they are very concerned in their minds about who is greatest. Which one of us? Obviously, the 12 of us have been chosen. And I mean, we could speculate that this might have sort of been brought along by Jesus separating Peter, James, and John and taking them up on the mountain. And perhaps that contributed to some jealousy on the part of the other nine. And so there's kind of some strife between them. And this strife is going to continue, in fact, as we move forward. This is by no means the end of it. But the very fact that this is the situation among them shows that they really just haven't understood rightly. They're not putting these things all together as they ought. And the question that they ask also reveals that they have a fixation on these rewards. They have a fixation on having the greatest or the most exalted place over others in the kingdom. And it reveals that there is a very proud sense of superiority within the 12 disciples. And the opening shows again that Jesus is talking here to the 12, and that's going to continue throughout chapter number 18. So he's not talking to the crowds, he's not addressing a multitude, he's talking to his disciples, the 12 that we've seen from several chapters ago that had been separated. Verse number 2, "And Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them." So in response to this dispute and this question from the disciples, Jesus takes a little child, and and the diminutive continues to be used in the account. In other words, it is indicating a little child. Could indicate anything from an infant to a young child. I think it's Mark actually that maybe mentions that Jesus actually took the child up in his arms and set him in their midst. So obviously referring to a pretty young child that he sets in the midst of them. Verse 3, and said, "Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now, the very end of this verse shows what the stakes are. So we start out being clued in that there's some nature of dispute between the disciples and some rivalry and jealousy between them. There's some fixation on reward of place. And we realize that this is a question not just of degrees of reward. That's really not where Jesus goes with this. This is about entering the kingdom or not. Those are the stakes. In fact, as you continue reading the passage, entering the kingdom is put parallel with entering into life. And the alternative is being cast into everlasting hellfire. So entering the kingdom, entering life, or being cast into everlasting hellfire. So this is about salvation. This is about the soul entering into life rather than eternal condemnation. Now, Matthew has already given us a few references about entering into the kingdom. In chapter 5 and verse number 20, Jesus said that they must have exceeding righteousness, the righteousness that exceeds that of scribes and Pharisees, if they will enter into the kingdom of heaven. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 7 and verse 21, Jesus warned that it's not those who say, "Lord, Lord," that enter into the kingdom, but it's those that do the will of his Father, which Jesus equates with obeying his words. And so this has already come up a few times in the gospel. We could turn to the other gospel accounts and see even some more references. The familiar conversation with Nicodemus in John chapter 3, where Jesus said that you had to be born again to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so there's other things that we could put with it, but we've already seen these references enough to know that the soul is at stake in this question. It's not just a matter the disciples think that they're just trying to find out what this pecking order is going to be. How are we going to be sorted out? And which one of us is going to be on top when the kingdom does finally come? That's what they think the question is about. But Jesus goes on to show, no, this is actually about your souls. This is about whether or not you enter into the kingdom, enter into life, or whether you are cast into everlasting hellfire. Now, Jesus here puts entering the kingdom in two terms here in this verse. The first is they must be converted. Now, the word that Jesus uses here for converted means to change, or it means to turn around, to turn completely around. So what is Jesus saying? He's saying that they must turn from the path of pride and self-exaltation that they are on. They must turn away from that completely. This dispute, this rivalry, this jealousy, this proud sense of superiority that you are experiencing, you must turn from that completely, is what Jesus is saying. So they must turn from pride. And the second term is that they must become like that little child that Jesus sat in their midst. Now, we may be able to think of a little child, and we may be able to come up with a list of of positive things about a little child, a little small child, and maybe even some negative things about a little small child, and we could just sort of take that and run with it. But we don't need to do that because Jesus has told us plainly what he means by this. And what he means by this is humility. That's what he means by it. Not innocence or purity or any number of other things that we may have heard in relation to this. He means humility, like this little child. In other words, not trying to wrangle for position, not trying to gain a leg up on someone else. So humility is what Jesus means. So they must be converted. They must turn around from the path of pride, and they must humble themselves. And that's what he says in verse number 4. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now the message of humility is not an entirely new message for these disciples. And one place where we see it is if we think back to Matthew chapter 10 and verses 24 to 28. Jesus said, the disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. It's enough for the disciple that he be as his master and the servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of the household? Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed and hid that shall not be known. What I tell you in darkness, that speak ye in light, and what ye hear in the ear, that preach ye upon the housetops. And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And again, we see reference to some of that same consequence, even though here it's related to fear more than it is to pride. But notice three things in particular in those few verses that speak to the humility that Jesus is talking about in this passage. Number one, he says, you're not greater than your master. You're not above him. You cannot get above him. You can't achieve more than him, so to speak. Number two, you are not then entitled to better treatment than what your master has received. So essentially, one of the things that Jesus says about humility is, if they have treated me this way, and we're studying the life of Jesus right now, and if they have treated me this way, how much more are they going to treat those servants of his household? So we're not above or going to be above the master. We're not entitled to better treatment than him. And then when it comes to ministry, essentially Jesus says, speak the truth in obedience and service and love, not out of competition, not out of ambition, and not out of superiority. So this humility is connected to service and serving others, in particular in Mark and Luke. Matthew doesn't make as much of an emphasis of that, but we can certainly see how that it is connected. Verse number 5. And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. Now, this word for receive means essentially to receive in fellowship, to take by the hand, could even be to sort of to take into the family and things of that nature, hospitality, and a lot of those kind of ideas are included there in receiving. Well, it's clear from the context that Jesus is not talking about little children as such. In other words, Jesus is not teaching children's ministry here. I'm not saying that it's wrong in any way to minister to children. I'm just saying Jesus is not talking about ministering to children as actual children. He's talking about believers, those who have humbled themselves like a little child, those who have turned from the way of pride and self-exaltation, those who have humbled themselves and are following Jesus. So what's he saying here? Receive one another. And if you think about, Paul used very similar language in Romans chapter number 14, where he talked about receiving each other. And if you think about what was going on in Romans 14 that Paul was addressing, he was addressing these differences of conscience between weaker and stronger consciences and those that had certain convictions in certain areas, though the Bible doesn't require that, and those that understood the liberty and the freedom and trying to balance those kind of things out. And he talked about receiving one another. In other words, you have to be able to receive one another in brotherhood and in fellowship and in a local church setting as members of the same body, being made one together in Jesus Christ. And so what's he saying here to the disciples? Well, think about what was going on with them was this argument between them, this dispute between them, this envy and jealousy between them about being the greatest. So in essence, Jesus is saying, rather than arguing with one another about which was greatest and condemning everyone that didn't follow them, which both Mark and Luke include in part of this account, but Matthew does not. But rather than doing that, he says, you should be receiving each other and receiving each other. The idea of being hospitable, receiving in fellowship, receiving as a brother, receiving as a sister. Verse number 6. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believes in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Now at this point, in verse number 6, and as we continue on in this part of the passage, from this point forward, it's more of a negative consideration. And here Jesus turns toward that, and he uses this word for offend, and this word for offend means to cause to stumble, to trip up. We've encountered it many times. So in the immediate context, what is the offense that Jesus is talking about of one of these little ones? Well, if you think about it, arguing about greatness is something that would stumble a little one. Think about what happens, in a group of children, and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some candy or some sort of treat or gift or something that's there, and they're all sort of, you know, biding their time and waiting, and then that first one rushes forward to get as much as they can. I mean, what happens? I mean, it's a free-for-all at that point. They just all sort of pile in. For the most part, you might have a few that don't. But that one that is just sort of was first in grabbing the candy or whatever that it was to, you know, greedily get all that they could for themselves sort of leads the others in the same behavior. So it's really not that much different, though. We're talking about adult men here arguing about who is greatest and who's going to have what position. Well, sooner or later, it can tend to play on the jealousies and the ambitions and the sense of entitlement of whatever we feel that we deserve, and then someone's going to be exalted above me, and then it just sort of has a chain reaction. And so Jesus is talking about not giving this kind of offense, not causing this kind of stumbling. And he uses a very vivid image. The millstone that he's referring to was a large stone. I mean, it was the stone that was used to grind up the grain, and it was so big that it had to be pulled by some sort of beast of burden. This wasn't a small stone or a little hand-operated job. It was a very large deal. Now, Jesus is obviously speaking hyperbolically, we would say, which means that he's using exaggeration sort of as a rhetorical device, and he does that a bit in this particular passage, but he's doing it to convey the seriousness. He says it's better to drown in the sea than it is to offend one of these little ones by leading them astray, causing them to stumble into pride and superiority and all of those sort of things. As he continues in verse 7, "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." So, Jesus pronounced a prophetic woe on the world because of these sort of stumblings. And it really doesn't take long of just stopping and thinking about it to think about all of these kind of stumblings. Now, oftentimes we probably think of them more in terms of temptations, but really it's the same thing. There's all sorts of stumblings that are presented us in the world. Well, because the kingdom is not here, and the kingdom is not coming in this age, it is inevitable, Jesus says, that offenses will come to believers in this present age. There's going to be opportunities of stumbling all around us all the time. We shouldn't be surprised by it. We shouldn't be taken by surprise. We should, in fact, expect it, because we have been told that this will be the case. So there are plenty of occasions of stumbling, but Jesus says, woe to that one who offends or causes such an offense, who causes such a stumbling. And so the implication then is that we need to be careful that we are not causing such an offense, that I am not causing someone to stumble in this way or that way. And then we look at verses 8 and 9. "Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It's better for thee to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire." So obviously this echoes from the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verses 29 to 30. And just as Jesus did there, he's using this hyperbolic type of language, so it's exaggerated language for rhetorical effect. Jesus has clearly shown, and the Bible elsewhere clearly shows, that the problem that we really have is an internal problem. That's the reason ultimately that we sin. It's not that we have sticky fingers, as the old saying, you know, would be. That's not the reason that we steal. We may have sticky fingers, so to speak, but the reason that we would steal comes from within. And Jesus has made that very, very plain. So the problem of sin and offense begins within, and it's just not fixed. It's not remedied. It's not cured by cutting off parts of the body. That doesn't change or cure the heart. And we've seen this all the way back into the book of Deuteronomy, when Moses is on the plains of Moab with that second generation of Israel, and he's preparing them to go into the promised land. And God gave this covenant to your fathers, and your fathers broke this covenant and did not keep this covenant. And God has essentially renewed this covenant with you, this second generation. You're going to go into the promised land. But ultimately, Moses says, you're not going to keep it either. And the problem is your uncircumcised hearts, is what he referred to. It's an internal problem. Just as Jesus was talking about the ritual hand washing. He said, it's not what you're putting into your body that's defiling you. It's what's coming out of it that's defiling you. It's what's coming out of your heart that's defiling you. So the warning that we're being given here is to beware of our own thoughts, that we be not taken in. Not only are we concerned about causing others to stumble, but we also have to be concerned about stumbling ourselves in our thoughts, in those things that we allow to take hold and take root within us. Think about the disciples. I mean, at this point, there was just an obsession with greatness and position and place and having a higher place than someone else and having others that are lower and so on. So again, the consequences are seen very clearly here. The consequences are entering life or being cast into everlasting hell fire. And just as it was in the case of the Sermon on the Mount, being cast it implies judgment, that there's been a judgment and condemnation and being cast into hell fire. Now, when we think about the Sermon on the Mount, you recall that the immediate context was lust. Jesus had talked about adultery and looking on a woman with lust. And so that was the immediate context. And here, it's pride. But it's very, very similar. The context is pride, and it's just as deadly to the soul. So much so that Jesus would say, it's better to lose an eye or to lose a hand or to lose a foot and go into eternal life that way than to have a whole body to be cast into hell. Well, then we see the next part in verses 10 to 14 in this parable of the lost sheep. We'll start with verse 10. Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. Now, what we have seen in the previous few verses was more about taking heed to yourself and being cautious of stumbling or giving occasion to stumbling in yourself. And now we're making a turn more toward taking heed toward others, that we're not offending or stumbling others. Now this verse here in verse number 10 has certainly given a lot of difficulties. It's given rise to quite an array of interpretations. But we don't make sure, first of all, that we don't miss the message of the verse. And the message of the verse is to be careful not to offend any of Christ's little ones. We don't want to be a stumbling block to others. And these are some of the things that Paul picked up on in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10 and in Romans chapter 14 and in the first part of chapter 15, where he was talking about willingly setting aside his liberty rather than offending one of these little ones. He didn't want to cause one to stumble into sin. And even though he had liberty in some area, he said he would willingly lay that aside rather than stumbling someone into sin. So it is a serious consideration. Don't cause them to stumble, especially in regards to pride and thinking themselves to be great. Now, the difficulty obviously comes in this phrase about in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. And the word for angel here, it is the word that is typically used that we think of as the spirit beings that are the servants of God. There's one case when Peter was in prison and you know the angel gets Peter out and then Peter goes to where they were gathered together praying. And in Acts chapter 12, verses 11 and 15, they talk about how that the maiden there that came to the door, she didn't open the door, but she heard Peter's voice, and she assumed that it was his angel. And that's the same word, but it certainly seems to be used more in the sense of that this was Peter's spirit in some way, because it sounded like Peter. And, of course, one of the ideas from such a verse is you know, these refers to the guardian angels, which is a peculiar way to view this verse, because if they are guardian angels that are assigned to be guarding believers that are on the earth, this verse says they are always in heaven beholding the face of the Father. So how are they guarding these believers on the earth? So, again, that's one of those ideas that's out there. Nevertheless, I believe it's probably speaking of their angels is referring to spirits, more in the sense of like Peter was. And it would, in that case, would be referring to departed believers that are always beholding the face of the Father. And you might think about the book of Revelation and those souls that are under the altar. And ultimately, the statement seems to be a statement of their value to God, what they mean to Him, because that seems to be the basis on which what follows is given. So look at verse 11. For the Son of Man is come to save that which was lost. So in light of that, Jesus expresses His mission in terms of saving these little ones. That's the implication. And again, it's a statement of their value to the Father. Verse number 12 then gets into this parable. How think ye, if a man have 100 sheep and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seeketh that which is gone astray? So he's illustrating his point now with this parable that takes verses 12 and 13 and then sort of the conclusion in verse number 14. The straying sheep that Jesus speaks about would be those little ones that have been offended, those little ones that have been led astray. And he's just saying in a normal course that any shepherd is going to leave that flock and go in search of that one that has strayed off. Verse 13, and if so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. So the point here is obviously this rejoicing. It's the point that he's driving at. Rejoicing at finding the straying one as one that's been sort of knocked off course and has been returned. And again, this speaks of their value to God. And then we get the conclusion in verse number 14. Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. So the conclusion is that the Father is not willing to lose even one of His little ones. And again, who are the little ones? Well, in this passage, the little ones are those who believe, those who have humbled themselves, those who believe in Jesus. And they have been offended. They've been stumbled. They've been led astray in some way. And in that case, then He likens them to the sheep of a fold and says the Father's not willing to lose even one. He's not going to look on and say, well, you know, I still have 99. And so, you know, just one. So I'll just let it go. No, He's not willing to do that. This is what he's illustrating in this parable. And it reinforces what Jesus was saying of why we must take heed not to offend, not to lead astray any of little ones that believe in Jesus. Now again, this was specially applicable to the apostles as they were responsible for, again, they had been called to an office. They'd been called to a work. They were being prepared for a mission that they were to undertake after that Jesus has gone away. And they need to take great care that they are not stumbling or leading astray any of those little ones. Well, this part of this section, and it does continue on till the end of chapter 35. It's somewhat transitions, but again, it's like we've seen before. It's all a unified piece of teaching. But this part of the section emphasizes that necessity of humility to enter the kingdom. The necessity of humility to truly be great. The necessity of humility to prevent offenses. And he's going to talk more about that particular point, especially and the offenses between each other and such as you look at the latter part of this teaching. So not only do we have to be careful of our own souls, that we're not stumbling in pride, we do have to be careful of the souls of others, that we're not stumbling them in pride, that we're not provoking them in some way to pride and to straying off. Now, the thoughts of being the greatest and who is the greatest and who's not, well, these are thoughts of pride that we've been shown in this passage. They don't lead to life. They don't lead to entrance into the kingdom. Jesus was clear that we have to turn away from that and humble ourselves in order to enter into life. And so it's important that we recognize that humility is not achieved by claiming it.